So look at that sunshine, look at that bright sunshine. This is 2013. 2012 was rain. 2013 is sun. It's a change. Yes. And it was very moving last night, I thought. We sort of came back down here from that amazing bonfire. I think it's the most fierce bonfire I've ever seen here at Padmaloka, that one. And then we were sitting in this room, or some of us were sitting in this room, as the year turned. Have you heard that phrase? I think it might be a country expression. They call it the turning of the year. And that's quite a nice sense, isn't it? You know, when the year changes. And it's not changing just because you're changing the digit at the end of the date. It's actually changing because you're passing through midwinter. And as we sat there through that moment, there were explosions outside, bangs, and our lives ticked through midnight, and 2012 changed to 2013. So midnight is the time of Amoghasiddhi, the Green Buddha of the north. The turning of the year, when winter approaches its darkest point, but the shifting times of dawn and dusk, already the dawn is earlier and the dusk is getting later. And that tells us that spring is on the way. And the turning of the year, the middle of the winter, is also the time of Amoghasiddhi, the Green Buddha. And already the green shoots of the bulbs are pushing through, and the green buds on the bushes and the trees are swelling up as if they could burst with just a couple of days of this bright, warm sunshine. I'm looking forward to seeing the first snowdrops and those yellow winter aconites. They'll be out very, very soon. New life is emerging, and Amoghasiddhi is also associated with that. Amoghasiddhi, in the scheme we're using on this retreat, is the Buddha of spiritual rebirth, the spiritual rebirth that follows spiritual death. And in the realm of Amoghasiddhi, we wake up just, not just in a new year, but also in a new life, a life informed by the insight of Amoghasiddhi. So there's a progression. Now, an insight is a realization. It's seeing things in a new way. But no insight is complete until it's percolated through the whole of you. And the whole of you includes the way you live and what you do. So insight is not just knowing something. It's knowing something that has an impact on what you do and how you live. This is where Amoghasiddhi comes in. Amoghasiddhi is the Buddha of action. His family is the Karma family, and Karma means action. And he's associated with a new kind of active engagement with life. Life informed by some appreciation of how things really work deep down. Not informed by opinions or conventional ways of doing things. Not even informed by the advice of somebody else, even a Buddha or some other wise person. But informed directly from one's own experience. An experience which to some extent goes beyond ego clinging. So imagine if you could act from that, if you could live from that. You actually were there with what was going on. You weren't having to work it all out secondhand, think it all through. There it was, reality, no separation between you and reality. And from that you acted. That's Amoghasiddhi's action. Amoghasiddhi is the Buddha of the action family, the Karma family. And karma, I think, is a much misused word. It doesn't mean some awful fate that you've got to put up with. Karma is a vehicle that takes you through life. It's not a prison van. And I want to say more about karma later on. But I want to go back to the mandala. We've been going round the mandala from the east, the blue, to the south, the yellow, to the west, the red, and now right round, all the way round to the north. From the sunrise of Akshobhya to the midday sun of Ratnasambhava to the sunset of the deep insight meditation of Amitabha. And now we've arrived at midnight, the witching hour, the turning of the year. With Akshobhya, we started by touching the earth. Feeling the immense stability of the ground beneath us. That's what Akshobhya's mudra represented. Feeling rooted, solid, mindful. Beginning to be completely present. So that is why Akshobhya reaches down and grounds himself. Grounds himself like an electrical circuit being earthed. And as the blue Buddha morphs into the yellow Buddha, you remember what happens to his hand. His hand turns around and it becomes the gesture of generosity, but it's still in contact with the rich, fertile yellow earth. It's both of these hands are at the level of the energy center known as the root center in the body. And in the case of the generosity mudra, it's the horse-like energy of the instincts that's represented at that root level, the energy of sexuality. But then as the yellow Buddha morphs into the red Buddha of the West, what happens to that right hand is that, as Vasantra pointed out, it moves upwards. So it moves upwards to a new center, and it's sitting in the lap, in the mudra of meditation, and now it rests beside the energy center, which is known in Japanese as the hara, just two finger breadths below the navel. And that energy center is very, very crucial. It's the very center of one's vitality. It's the place to reside if you want the mind to quieten. It's the center from which your strength comes, for example, in Tai Chi. That's the place that gently rises and falls as you meditate on the breath. So in gradually coming to terms with ourselves, in developing the stages of the spiritual path, we can gradually rise up through the body, at least in imagination. We establish a foundation. And that foundation is not something that we leave behind, but it's something that we build on. We turn then outwards from the inner stability and we become aware of other people with positive emotion. And then we rise to the very center of gravity of our being, the hara. And from that center, we look reality in the face. We allow our self-clinging to die. And at least some realizations, some insights, inform our lives. So what does the hand do next? Well, you can see it rises. It rises again. It rises from the hara up to the level of the heart. And once again it turns outwards, this time in the gesture of courage. And for Buddhism, the heart center, I would say, is the center par excellence. I remember I used to go to massage classes led by Vajradhaka, who's a fantastic massage teacher. And he would teach you the strokes, he would teach you how to do this, the techniques, and how to stand, and the amount of pressure to use. But what he would say in the end is that it's not to do with pressing in the right place. It's not to do with pushing with the right degree of force. It's to do with the heart. Mm. He says that the massage must come from the heart. And he taught us how to have metta pouring out from your fingers, from your hand as you massage. And you could feel, as you did this, you could feel your hand getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And the person can feel it. They can detect that sense that you're massaging with love, you're not massaging just with force. And that makes all the difference. You're connecting with the person, in other words, with the human being. So the heart center, in a way, is the most important center in Buddhism. And the heart, the heart is the seat of the mind. Now, of course, modern scientists will say, oh yes, Aristotle got it wrong. Aristotle thought that the mind was here, but actually it's here. But that's not true. Neither of them is true, actually. I mean, one's mind, in other words, one's inner life, is extended through your whole body. In fact, it's more than extended through your body. It's extended beyond your body. The mind is not something that can be located in a particular organ. Now, it's true that you can measure brain activity and show that that is very closely correlated with things that are happening on the mental level, but there are also other parts of the body which are closely correlated with what happens on the mental level, and there are things happening outside which are closely correlated with what happens on the mental level. The mental level is not to do solely with chemical and physical activity in a particular organ. That's important, it's very interesting, it's an amazing area of study, but I think it's a very serious mistake that people make if they say the mind is the brain. Anyway, that's an interesting area which I'm not going to go into anymore. But from a Buddhist point of view, they say you're the centre of your being, the centre of your awareness. It's best to place it here, in your breast, in your heart centre. Not in the pulsing organ of the heart so much, but in that centre of the body, that place. And the Abhaya Mudra, the mudra of courage, in this case it's held up here. But if you look at Tara, who's also the female Buddha of Amoghasiddhi's family, she also demonstrates the Abhaya Mudra with her left hand, and it's right by her heart. And I think more commonly the Abhaya Mudra is by the heart, in front of the heart, in whatever way, it's at the level of the heart, anyway. So we turn outwards from the inner stability of Amitabha, and we become aware of others with positive emotion. Perhaps in Tai Chi you operate from the hara down here, but in Buddhism, if you can, you operate from the heart. But remember that we've arrived at the heart only by rising up from the solidity of akshobhya and the positive emotion of ratnasambhava. So you've got to go through, as it were, the life of the belly as well, to get up to the heart. It's no good trying to go straight to the heart without being embodied first. Of course, very often we tend to miss out the heart altogether and go straight into the head and stay there. I mean, that's certainly my tendency, thinking, thinking, and thinking. But if you look around the Buddhas of the Mandala, none of them have a mudra which is up here. So this gesture is a communication. It's not a warding off. It's not saying through gritted teeth, I'm not scared, please go away, please go away, please go away. It's not the gesture of courage in that sense, the gesture of fearlessness. Alokavira last night, while we were around the bonfire, he noticed me holding my hand up like this against the fierceness of the heat, you know. And he said, oh, you're practicing your Abhaya Mudra for tomorrow, are you? But that's not really what the Abhaya Mudra is about. It's not sort of shielding yourself, nor even is it sort of holding out a sort of a Star Wars hand and zapping people from your palm or something like that. That's not what the mudra is about. It's said to be the mudra that bestows courage. It's a message to me if I'm fearful or anxious, and it says, calm down. It says, remember the heart, calm down. Let the heart soften, be open. Come to meet whatever is there. Turn to face the experience that's bothering you. So it's always worth it being with whatever happens. There's no need to flee. There's no need to run away. So the gesture represents Amoghasiddhi's active engagement with life and his encouragement to us to actively engage with whatever we encounter. And like the other mudras, the gesture originates in an incident in the historical Buddha's life. So an elephant trained for executions, because that's what they used to use sometimes in India to kill people. In fact, they did in Burma until quite recently, use elephants for trampling people to death. So this one is a homicidal elephant. It's not an elephant that's going to avoid harming anybody. It was made drunk on beer, and it was released when the Buddha was walking down the road with the intention of killing him. This is a serious attempt on the Buddha's life. And as it thundered towards him, trumpeting, its little red eyes glaring with anger, the story says he simply held up his hand in the Abhaya Mudra, in the Mudra of Courage, and he suffused the elephant with metta He sent powerful waves of kindness and goodwill towards the animal, not at all concerned for his own safety. And the elephant slowed down. It became calm. Down went the trunk. And according to the story, it knelt down in front of the Buddha and paid him homage with the tip of its trunk. So this courage mudra radiates kindness and metta. That's what's coming from that palm. Kindness and metta. It's not a barrier trying to ward off problems. The Buddha wasn't trying to use some kind of magical force to deflect the elephant. He was simply communicating intense kindness towards it. So it's very interesting to reflect on the connection between courage, confidence, fearlessness on the one hand, and going out with kindlessness. Courage is when you're not sort of hiding within your little castle. Courage is when you open. And you open to the possibility of things going wrong and of discomfort. Now, Buddhism originated in northeast India. And if the early Buddhists thought of the north, which is Amoghasiddhi's direction, their imaginations would have run to the hills and the mountains that lead up to the roof of the world, the Himalayas. They would have thought of vast tracts of dark green forest with eagles soaring above the trees. So the animal who supports Amoghasiddhi is something like an eagle, but it also has human characteristics. Sometimes it's the Garuda, with the head of an eagle, the torso and arms of a man, and the wings and talons of an eagle. Sometimes it's the strange Tibetan Shangshang bird, whose head is also human, and who clashes symbols together with his muscular arms. But always the creatures supporting Amoghasiddhi are flying. They fly through the air. Amoghasiddhi's element is the air. He brings with him a sense of freedom, the ability to soar, to rise up, to stoop like a falcon, to speed as fast as a falcon through the air, and to change direction without difficulty. So flying freely, that's the sort of the image for Amoghasiddhi, Amoghasiddhi's active wisdom. And Amoghasiddhi's emblem, which you can see here, is the double vajra. And you form a double vajra by taking two vajras and crossing them over, like that. And that's what we were doing with the resolutions, placing a vajra one way and a vajra the other way. So they're two orthogonal vajras at 90 degrees to each other. They're adding an additional dimension to the linear vajra. So it's got the strength and the dynamism of the diamond thunderbolt, but it's crossed. And Lama Govinda says that the double vajra represents the union of opposites. So whatever irreconcilable alternatives you can think of, imagine them coming together. Imagine them both being allowed to coexist and forming some higher unity, something magical, something quite unexpected. So you might think, either my energy goes into meditation or it goes into my work and family. They contradict each other. They oppose each other. But then imagine that your life was two crossed vajras. Then somehow the meditation and the work and family are feeding and enhancing each other and producing an integrated life. So is there a way that could happen? I don't know. But that's what a double vajra is trying to achieve. Or you want time by yourself, but you also need contact with others. Two opposing vajras. Can they be reconciled? So it's always worth thinking of that. I think we do tend to be a bit polarized in our views. We think we either have to be like this or we have to be like this. And that's what they call the left brain approach, I suppose, isn't it? But maybe not. Maybe you can bring the two vajras together, united at their center. And in the sutra called the Vimalakirti Nidesha, this process of uniting two vajras is called the Dharma door of non-duality, or the entrance to non-duality. And here are some examples from the sutra as explained by Sangharakshita, by Bhante. So the sutra says, distraction, and attention are two. Integration is the entry into non-duality. So you don't need to fight with the distractions. Working on yourself and working on others are two, or working for others are two. But realizing that such distinctions between self and other are in the end illusory is a Dharma door to non-duality. You can't make progress yourself without taking an interest in others, and you can't help others unless you're working on yourself. So what seemed like two contradictory dual processes actually can be brought together and must be. Another example from the sutra, sinfulness and sinlessness are two, but a wise individuality which isn't under the thumb of the group, isn't under the thumb of conventional mores, is the Dharma door to non-duality. And in his lecture on the sutra, Sangharakshita has some examples of his own of these dualities, which I'll just give you. You can talk about them if you want to. I'm not going to try and explain them. Organizer and organized are two. Cooperation is the entrance into non-duality. Teacher and taught are two. Communication is the entrance into non-duality. Masculine and feminine are two. Celibacy is the entrance into non-duality. Individual and group are two. The Sangha is the entrance into non-duality. But maybe we can think of this also on a more basic level. The dualities, at a more basic level, are known as the worldly winds, the loka dharmas. And Vasantra has already mentioned the worldly winds. Now, actually, there are thousands of worldly winds, but conventionally, in the sutras, the main list is of four pairs: pleasure and pain, praise and blame, gain and loss, and, as I would translate them, popularity and neglect. Pleasure and pain, you know, we go for one. This is what the Buddha, when he explains them, he says, we welcome the pleasure, but we reject the pain, or we rebel against the pain. And this is just completely natural, isn't it? You welcome the pleasure, but you rebel against the pain. And the same goes for the others. Praise and blame. You welcome the praise, you rebel against the blame. Gain and loss. You welcome the gain, you rebel against the loss. Popularity and neglect. You welcome the popularity, you rebel against the neglect, being ignored. Terrible thing. And these are the winds that blow you back and forth. They buffet you in life. No sooner are you preening and glowing under the praise of somebody at work than you get blamed for something that's gone wrong, probably unfairly. And immediately you deflate and you get really annoyed and irritated and fed up. So, Amoghasiddhi is the Buddha of the wind. His element is air, or the wind element. And his double vajra blasts through the dualities that blow us this way and that. And it carries us in a different direction. It's as if rather than saying, let's blow ourselves towards the pleasure and away from the pain, it's sort of, there's a gust, and you go, whoop, you go upwards instead. And your perspective increases. You look down on both the pleasure and the pain. You see they're both, William Blake says, joy and pain are woven fine, a clothing for the soul divine. They are not two things that you can separate out from each other. They're the warp and the weft of life, joy and pain. So instead of from side to side, we're going upwards. And you can see that these elements, praise and blame and so on, they're imposters. I think Rudyard Kipling calls them imposters, doesn't he? And they're not worth taking too seriously. They're not worth living from. And then maybe we find some Dharma door from that higher perspective that can take us into a non-duality. Now, I mentioned that Amoghasiddhi is the Buddha of action. He presides over the karma family. And the word karma simply means action. It's whenever you do something, whenever you intervene in the world physically, or even with your voice, or even by thinking something, that is a karma. It's when any input translates into an output, and experience leads you to act. That's karma. Now, Amoghasiddhi's action is not really karma in that sense. It's something very subtle and mysterious, because it comes out of the non-duality of the double Vajra. It emerges from his all-performing wisdom, as it's called. So it's the action that's the next step after the deep insights of Amitabha. You don't just smugly rest in your realizations, but you see that your realizations have actually got some implications. They're telling you something. They mean that you can change your life, that... some blank pages appearing here. That you can get involved, you can make a difference in the world. But you make a difference from a completely realistic perspective. Amoghasiddhi's all-performing wisdom produces action that goes beyond karma in the usual sense. So Amoghasiddhi's name literally means can't fail attainment. Amoga, Atmoga, cannot fail. Siddhi, attainment. And it's often translated as infallible success. He knows exactly how much to do to produce a really helpful result, and he doesn't do any more than that. He's very deft. However, we probably haven't got that deep wisdom, and so our action may be at times rather clumsy. Sometimes it doesn't produce the results that we want. Very often it comes from a defensive, small mind. But one of the tenets in Buddhism, one of the central tenets, is that actions, karmas, always have effects. So you can't ignore it. You can't just hope that you'll get to Amoghasiddhi's wisdom level and it's all solved. You've got to actually look at what you're doing. You've got to look at your actions. And the reason is because they do make a difference. What you do, even what you say and what you think, it makes a difference. It's actually quite, in a way, it's quite inspiring to know that, because I think sometimes we feel that we have no effect in the world. You know, we just look at these great forces pushing the stock markets and climate change, and we think, puny, tiny little me, what impact do I have? But actually, the whole world is made up of individual impacts, and we're part of that, and we're having those impacts on the people around us, maybe even broader than that. So whatever you do, whatever you say or think, it does have repercussions. And they're not random, these repercussions. They're governed by the laws of karma. And the laws of karma are basically very simple. Positive, helpful, what are called skillful actions, will have beneficial consequences, and they'll lead to happy experiences for you in the long run. Unskillful actions, which are driven by defensiveness or the neediness of the small mind, driven by fear or willful ignorance, they're going to cause damage and trouble in the long run. And they'll lead to your life going wrong. They'll lead to unhappiness. They'll lead to problems. So this means that how our life is now, if we just look at our life as it is now, here on this retreat or when we're at home, it's in part constrained and affected by how we behaved in the past. And how we behaved has turned us into the kind of person that we are. And that's led to how life seems to treat us. We interact with our life in a particular way that makes our experience seem in a particular way. And it can even be very specific things that happen to us that actually have a karmic connection. Like somebody else losing our temper is partly to do with us. It's not to do just with them. So sometimes these consequences of karma, they can seem like a heavy burden. It can seem like we are burdened with the past. We're just carrying around this enormous rucksack full of rocks the whole time, which is our past, weighing us down. All the habits we've set up, all the echoes from what we've done in the past that are now catching up with us, and we can't avoid them. Just think of the mistakes that we've made in our relationships. Have you ever made a mistake in a relationship? Think of our poor diet. Think of our bad sleep patterns that we've set up. Think of the connections with people that we failed to maintain, failed to keep up. I'm looking at the negative, as you may have noticed here. Those are the positive as well. So the past constrains us. And particularly when we're feeling pessimistic, when we're feeling trapped, it can seem as if we've been driven to this place in our life, in the prison van of past karma. And we can even think of other people in that same judgmental light. this horrible version of karma that says that if things go wrong for people, it's because they were bad in the past and they deserve it. So we shouldn't bother to help them because they deserve it and they should have to go through it. What was that England football manager who... Yeah, Glenn Hoddle, who had that attitude towards disabled people. Now, this is not the Buddhist position. This is by no means the Buddhist position. And there are two reasons why this is not an appropriate view or an appropriate response, either to ours or either to ourselves or to when we're looking at other people. One of these reasons is that karma is not the only form of conditionality. There are many other reasons why things might be difficult, why we get ill, or why we lose our job. And also, there are other reasons why things might go well. They're not necessarily all to do with our past actions. And just in brief, according to Buddhist tradition, you've got your five orders of conditionality, your five niyamas, and I'll mention the first four of them, and then come to the fifth one later. Conditionality operates on the purely physical level. So maybe the rain causes a flood, and you can't get through with your car, and so you're late for work. You're not late for work, at least not directly, because of karma. You're late for work because the rain caused the road to flood. It's a physical cause. And it happens also on the biological level. So picking up an infection or getting food poisoning, something like that might be the biological level, and thousands of other things. And it also operates on the mental level, such as the instinctive sense of hunger or sexual attraction that we've got, or the instinctive sense of shrinking from danger. This is mental conditionality that isn't to do with volitional actions, not to do with karma. So all those levels might explain why we're facing certain situations. And all the levels interact with each other. You can't even isolate. You can't say it was only because of the rain that I was late for work. There are other, many other factors as well. I wasn't driving an amphibious vehicle at the time. They also, they interact, all these levels interact with the karmic level, the volitional level of the actions that we decide to pursue as well. Now, there's another reason as well why the fatalistic and blaming view of karma is inappropriate, and that's because it forgets about now. It forgets about the present moment. We're actually acting now. We are not just driven here and stuck in that prison van. We are actually, at least to some extent, free to make decisions. And we're affecting our future by what we do right now. A despondent or a blaming attitude is unskillful. If we take that kind of attitude to ourselves or to other people, it's going to make things worse because it in itself is karmic. If we're sympathetic, if we're helpful to others, whatever we think the reasons they've got themselves into their current predicament, then that is skillful karma. And skillful karma, as well as being helpful, also improves things for us. So that's a little bit about those four levels of conditionality and also about remembering that karma is an active process you're engaged in. It's not just something that sweeps, that washes you up on the beach and there you are. But what if your actions were more than just trying to be kind and helpful? What if they were more than just skillful karma? What if they were informed by Amitabha's wisdom? Wisdom brings in another form of conditionality, which is quite different from the other kinds, the four other kinds. Wisdom is when one's aligned with the way things really are, going with the grain of reality. And then the duality of skillful and unskillful, there's a Dharma door that opens. And there's a Dharma door from skillful and unskillful that opens into non-duality through wisdom. So the subtle action of a Moggacitta is like the flight of an eagle in the sky. It's got a taste of enormous freedom and spontaneity. It's action that springs naturally from the all-performing wisdom. And in fact, there's a very mysterious progression in the wisdoms of the four Buddhas on the outside of the mandala. Lama Govinda describes this in terms of what's known as the fourfold contemplation of the great Zen master Rinzai, who I assume is the Zen master who gave his name to the Rinzai school. Is that right? Yes, we believe so. So I'll just quote from Lama Govinda. First of all, in the wisdom of the great mirror, which is, of course, Akshobhya's wisdom, we destroy the subject and the subjective conception of the world in favour of the objective suchness. So the mirror-like wisdom just displays things as they really are, without our subjectivity getting involved. So in that sense, it's, as it were, an objective wisdom. Now we move around to the wisdom of equality, Ratnasambhava. We destroy the object, the separating differentiation of the outer world of appearance, in favour of the subject, which is the living beings that we're involved with. So this is the wisdom of equality, the wisdom of positive emotion, where you now have destroyed the objective and you're entirely, as it were, in the subjective, in a warm, sympathetic, open way. In the analytical wisdom of inner vision, which is what Govinda calls Amitabha's wisdom, we neither destroy the subject nor the object, because we've reached the ultimate freedom in which... I've just ruined that little thing. No, we destroy both the subject and the object in the final experience of openness or shunyata. So in a way, now there's no duality at all with Amitabha. You've destroyed the subject and the object. But, and this is the twist, I suppose, in a way, in the all-accomplishing wisdom of Amoghasiddhi, we neither destroy the subject nor the object. Because we've reached the ultimate freedom in which we, like the Buddha after his enlightenment, can return into the world for the benefit of all living beings, and this without danger to ourselves, because we don't cling any more to the world. So Amoghasiddhi comes back. Amitabha, you know, to caricature a bit, Amitabha takes you to the Dharma Dhatu, to the realm of reality itself, where there are no dualities, where everything is just completely shunyata, completely open. But Amoghasiddhi says, don't stay there. We're coming back into the ordinary world, the world of subject and object, but interacting with it in a completely new way. Which is also a bit reminiscent of the Zen, the well-known Zen saying about mountains and waters. You know that one? That before you meditate, mountains are mountains and waters are waters. After some insight, the mountains are no longer mountains and the waters are no longer waters. Everything is transformed. Everything looks different. But when insight is complete, the mountains are once again mountains and the waters are once again waters. There was a song, wasn't there? Was it Donovan?
Yeah.
First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is Zen. So you can see the world in an ordinary way again. You can be involved with it, you can be engaged with it, but you're not fooled by it. So this means that the interventions of a very wise person, maybe the interventions of a Buddha like Amoghasiddhi, are very, very subtle. They want to make a difference, but not forcefully, not willfully. The elephant charges down the road, and there's just this little subtle flick of the hand, just like that, you know, and the interaction becomes something quite different. And there's a lovely example from the Sufi tradition. So the Sufi master was teaching a great crowd of disciples in a big hall, and somehow a bird got in and was trapped, and it's flying, flapping frantically around near the high windows. And there was this terrible rumpus from everybody. Then they stopped listening to the talk completely and got completely obsessed by this bird. And some of them were trying to shoo it through the windows. Others were trying to catch it with their Sufi hats. And others of them were trying to coax it with crumbs. And the bird got into more and more of a panic, bashing itself against the glass, panting with terror. And the Sufi master eventually managed to get everyone to calm down and just sit there quietly. And then he watched the bird. And after a while, the bird was just simply flying regularly, round and round, round and round the ceiling. And he watched it very carefully, and he suddenly went, and the bird vanished. Because his clap had been at the very moment the bird was passing the open window. Just this little subtle gesture, because he was so aware, and in a way so in tune with the bird itself, he just knew what to do. And the bird was free. It was completely free. So the Sufi story is meant to illustrate what needs to happen with us as well. There's a very subtle little intervention just a clap of the hands at the right moment in the middle of our meditation, and suddenly we're there. Does that ever happen when you hear the bell going or something? You know, you were all over the place, and then the bell, or even something falling over, you know, and, oh, goodness, I'm here. And you might even stay there for seconds or even minutes on end. So good luck with that. But this is all very well, but what if you don't have the all-performing wisdom? What if you haven't completed Amitabha's cycle of insight? You're not enlightened, nor maybe not even nearly enlightened. But I think there is hope for us. I think we can always translate these lofty Buddhist teachings so that they become relevant for the level at which we are operating. Do take them seriously at their non-dual level, but also consider our own level, the level we're operating on at the moment. So the subtle action of a Moggacitta is action informed by a realistic appreciation of life and informed by some degree of kindness and compassion. And I think we've all got those two factors. We've got some realization, we've got some kindness. Are you prepared to deny this? I think we all have our insights. Don't you think it's the case that during our lives we have learnt at least one or two things, at least a bit, and genuinely learnt as well? Sometimes we make the same mistakes over and over again, but sometimes we don't. We've learnt from our mistakes. We've gained a new perspective. Now, these realizations, they may not be huge, ego-destroying insights, but they are genuine, I think, and they're worth taking seriously. So I would suggest that in the groups after this, you maybe talk about what insights you've had in your life. Have you found ways of dealing with your irritation or your addictions? Have you found ways of getting on better with other people? Have you found ways of coping with your moods? What's that kind of thing I'm talking about? And if you can identify any insight, maybe it's an insight that's come to you this week here at Padmaloka. That is really precious. Please, please don't lose it. It's so precious to have some realization. Don't boast about it, don't inflate it, but don't lose it. And I would suggest a particular process for dealing with it. First of all, notice the insight. You know, you can just let it, you might sort of, in the meditation, you might, oh, right, that's true, isn't it? And then by the end of the meditation, you've completely forgotten it. So just notice it. And maybe try to put it into words, perhaps. Maybe try to write it down. It's not the insight, it's just words, but it may remind you of it so that you can look at the words later. And then decide to take it seriously. Dwell on it. Let it sink in. Let it affect you. So just go over it in your mind, in the reflective mood that Basantra was using in one or two of the meditations. And then consider, what are its implications? Does it imply some sort of action? Does it imply some kind of change to the way you live? If you take it seriously, you'll allow it to affect you. You won't just say, oh, I realised something new, but I just realised it. So what? It must have some implications. And finally, act on it and live from it. And go back to it and review it later and then act again. So a Moggacitta's wisdom is the wisdom of spiritual rebirth. It's about applying your most thorough and deepest experiences at every level of your life. So the experience is there, the awakening is there, the spiritual death is there, but now it's percolating, it's transforming you. And then perhaps you'll realise that subtle action, subtle interventions are sometimes possible, even for us. Just knowing what the right thing is, having a trust in your intuitions and seeing that those intuitions are not too caught up with self-concern and then acting. So, for example, it might become increasingly clear to you that your sister and her husband are having big problems in their relationship, and maybe you can see the effect it's having on both of them, the suffering it's causing to them and their children. And maybe there's nothing you can do. Maybe, to be honest, there's nothing you can do. You just have to leave them to it. But it could be that you decide, well, I think I'll go up and see them and just see what transpires. Not thinking that you know what is best for them, that's very dangerous. Not thinking that you have all the answers, that you're the wise advisor, but just being there for them, maybe offering some practical help, a sympathetic ear, a neutral voice, and maybe something that you could do will appear to you from the realm of Omega City, that subtle action. Or maybe you realise that governments are not doing enough to deal with environmental problems, and maybe you can see a way of getting involved, joining a campaigning group or something like that, at least changing the way you live, intervening. Not coming from your anxiety or your indignation, but coming from a growing perspective, from a feeling of empathy with others, including the decision makers. And I think, for myself, I think I've benefited a lot in my life from other people's kind interventions. And when I was thinking about this, my mind went right back to when I was at primary school. I was 10 years old in the final year there, and my teacher was Mr. Norris. And I started writing stories. I got a bit obsessed with this, writing stories. And he was amazingly encouraging. And what I remember in particular was when he took one of my stories, which was a science fiction story, because that's what I was reading at the time, and he laboriously typed the whole thing up on a manual typewriter, leaving gaps for me to add pictures, and he bound it in a nice cardboard cover. And he did this in his evenings, you know, not during the day, and he gave it back to me. Now, I don't think that was something premeditated. I don't think it's something he read about in a manual of teaching. This is a good thing to do. I think it just came to him that he wanted to do that. And supremely generous and a very, very encouraging action. It was intuitive. He could encourage me by doing something very practical, by taking some trouble himself. And I feel immensely grateful to him for his kindness. Actually, he was a young guy, Mr. Norris. He, I mean, of course, I was only 10, but he was only probably in his early 20s, not long married. And one day, I remember, he brought in his wife and his newborn baby into the class and stood, the three of them stood in front of the class to be admired by the 30 children. And I can just remember the sweet smile on his face, and also he was quite shy and the blush of embarrassment that he had as he showed them in. But again, that I think was because he wanted to share his life with us. He wanted to be a human being in the human realm, interacting, introducing us children to that human realm and what the human realm was like. So it's very subtle little things, isn't it, that? You know, it's not sort of being a fantastic rescuer of everybody. It's just doing those little positive deeds. And I think the action does need to be deft, needs to be subtle. On the other hand, Omega City presides over the realm of the Asuras, the Titans, the jealous gods. And they represent the kind of people who are active, very powerful, enormously active in the world of business or politics or something like that. And they're striving for status, they're striving for success, and they're doing each other down. So the poison that Omega City transforms is the poison of envy, where we're always thinking about how our performance, our actions, compare with that of others. So on the Wheel of Life, the Titans, they're green with the envy of the Devas. They're very envious of the gods. And the gods possess the wish-fulfilling tree. But the Titans' response is not to learn skillful behaviour, so that their lives will become happier and they'll be able to pluck the fruits of the wish-fulfilling tree. Their response is to take a huge axe and chop the tree down in the hopes that they can grab its fruits for themselves. So the action of envy kills the wish-fulfilling tree. The action of envy kills the wish-fulfilling tree. Okay, time to sum up. Omega City represents the real and active effects of wisdom. And that includes the little realizations, I think, that we all have, ensuring we don't lose them, finding ways of acting from them. And in traditional Buddhist terms, Omega City represents the path of transformation that follows the path of vision in the system of the five paths, the path of transformation, allowing the implications of our vision to change our lives. And maybe we can do that for the year 2013, making careful and realistic resolutions allowing what we've seen to affect the way we are in the year 2013. And I said that Amoga City holds up his hand near his heart in the mudra, the gesture of courage. He's got the courage to intervene, to act, not just sitting back, being passive. Buddhism shouldn't be quiescent. I think Buddhists, if they can, should be engaging with the world, with people. And I mentioned Amoga City's associations, for example, the Garuda of the mountains flying through Amoga City's air element. Amoga City's green colour, his consort, Green Tara, who one could say a lot about, but I won't. But her name means, as Vasandra said last night, her name means she who ferries across. Amoga City's time of midnight and midwinter. And I also mentioned his double vajra, the union of opposites, and the way that we can allow apparently contradictory factors in our lives, such as the worldly winds, to release their energy on a new level, which is connected with his name, Amoga City's name, attainment can't fail. And I talked about karma, action, how this can be skillful and unskillful, how the past can seem to be a prison van constraining us, but the future is open. And I talked about Amoga City's subtle action that springs from the all-performing wisdom. But sometimes the best form of action is doing nothing at all. I certainly need to tell myself this. The reason that Amoga City's action is not the same as the ordinary dualistic kind of karma is because it's completely present. It's not something that's simply the accumulation of past experiences and decisions that's sort of driven you up to this point. It's spontaneous, it's now. In a way, it's outside time, because the present moment is not to do with past and future, it's outside time. So in the present moment, one can open one's eyes and one can feel and see the influence of Amoga City. You can have the sense of the whole mandala, maybe the mandala above us and around us, with the mantra sounding. And one can simply absorb the effects of the mantra and the effects of the mandala. You can sit in the meditations which are associated with the spiritual rebirth. These are the meditations which sit in the presence of the Buddha, open to the influence of the Buddha, receptive to the vast presences in the universe, the presences that represent reality and enlightenment. And sitting in the presence of the Buddha, sitting in the presence of the mandala, which is what we've been doing here. And there awareness is completely present, but it's not just in the body, it's not even just in the heart and the warmth of the heart, it's not even in the insights that have come to us, but it's an awareness which is just open, open to everything. So I won't say any more, but I will suggest some questions for the groups. How do you respond to the characteristics of Amoga City? So you may just want to talk about the figure of Amoga City and his associations. And what about that mudra? How do you experience fears and anxieties? Do you experience fears and anxieties? What's the mudra of courage for you? And then what about the worldly winds, the other opposites that you experience in your life? Can you reconcile them? Can you tap their energy on a higher level? And then karma. Do you feel that your actions, even your words and your thoughts, always have effects? Is the idea of skillful and unskillful useful to you? But I think most important of all is maybe, if you want to talk about the insights, the realizations that you have had, how you could live from them, how you could remember them, how you could deepen them, and what kind of subtle actions do they imply? Thank you. Now, time for tea.